trunk. Servants were lined up in the hall and subjected to the threats of Inspector Johnny Vakil. "Come on, own up now," laughed the stick, tapping against his leg, "or you'll see what we can do to you. You want to stand on one leg all day and night? You want water thrown over you, sometimes boiling hot, sometimes freezing cold? We have many methods in the police force." And now, a cacophony of noise from servants.
"Not me, Inspector Saab. I'm honest boy. For pity's sake, search my things, Saab."
And Amina, "This is too much, sir. You go too far. My Mary, I know anyway, is innocent. I will not have her questioned." Suppressed irritation of police officer. A search of belongings is instituted.
"Just in case, madam, these fellows have limited intelligence, and maybe you discovered the theft too soon for the felon to abscond with the booty."
The search succeeds. In the bedroll of Musa the old bearer, a silver spittoon, wrapped in his puny bundle of clothes, gold coins, a silver samovar, secreted under his charpoy bed, a missing tea service, and now Musa has thrown himself at Ahmed Sanai's feet. Musa is begging,
"Forgive, Saab. I was mad. I thought you were going to throw me into the street."
But Ahmed Sanai will not listen. The freeze is upon him.
"I feel so weak," he says,
and leaves the room. And Amina, aghast, asks,
"But Musa, why did you make that terrible oath?"
"Because in the interim between line-up in passageway and discoveries in servants' quarters, Musa had said to his master,
'It was not me, Saab. If I have robbed you, may I be turned into a leper. May my old skin run with sores.'"
Amina, with horror on her face, awaits Musa's reply. The bearer's old face twists into a mask of anger. Words are spat out,
"Begum Shaiba, I only took your precious possessions, but you and your Saab and his father have taken my whole life, and in my old age you have humiliated me with Christian hires.'"
There is silence in Buckingham Villa. Amina has refused to press charges, but Musa is leaving. Bedroll on his back, he descends a spiral iron staircase, discovering that ladders can go down as well as up. He walks away, down hillock, leaving a curse upon the house. And was it the curse that did it? Mary Pereira is about to discover that even when you win a battle, even when staircases operate in your favour, you can't avoid a snake. Amina says,
"I can't get you any more money, Ishmael. Have you had enough?"
And Ishmael,
"I hope so. But you never know. Is there any chance of—"
But Amina, "The trouble is, I've got so big and all, I can't get in the car anymore. It will just have to do." Time is slowing down for Amina once more. Once again, her eyes look through leaded glass in which red tulips, green-stemmed, dance in unison. For a second time, her gaze lingers on a clock tower which has not worked since the rains of 1947. Once again, it is raining. The racing season is over. A pale blue clock tower. Squat, peeling, inoperational. It stood on black tarred concrete at the end of the circus ring, the flat roof of the upper story of the buildings along Warden Road, which abutted our two-story hillock, so that if you climbed over Buckingham Villa's boundary wall, flat black tar would be under your feet. And beneath black tar, Breech Candy Kindergarten School, from which, every afternoon, during term, there rose the tinkling music of Miss Harrison's piano, playing the unchanging tunes of childhood. And below that, the shops, Reader's Paradise, Fat Boy Jewellery, Chamalka's Toys, and Bombelli's, with its windows filled with 1 yards of chocolates. The door to the clock tower was supposed to be locked, but it was a cheap lock, of a kind Nadir Khan would have recognised, made in India. And on 3 successive evenings immediately before my first birthday, Mary Pereira, standing by my window at night, noticed a shadowy figure floating across the roof, his hands full of shapeless objects, a shadow which filled her with an unidentifiable dread. After the third night, she told my mother, the police were summoned. And Inspector Vakil returned to Methold's estate, accompanied by a special squad of crack officers.
"All Deadeye shots, Begum Sheba. Just you leave it all to us."
Who, disguised as sweepers,
with guns concealed under their rags, kept the clock tower under surveillance while sweeping up the dust and the circus ring. Night fell. Behind curtains and chick blinds, the inhabitants of Methil's estate peered fearfully in the direction of the clock tower. Sweepers absurdly went about their duties in the dark. Johnny Vakil took up a position on our veranda, rifle just out of sight. And at midnight, a shadow came over the side wall of the Breach Candy School and made its way towards the tower with a sack slung over one shoulder.
"He must enter," Vakil had told Amina. "Must be sure we get the proper Johnny."
The Johnny, padding across flat tarred roof, arrived at the tower, entered.
"Inspector Saab, what are you waiting for?"
"Shh, Begum. This is police business. Please go inside somewhere. We shall take him when he comes out. You'll mark my words, caught,"
Vakil said with satisfaction, "like a rat in a trap."
"But who is he?"
"Who knows?" Vakil shrugged. "Some budmash for sure. There are bad eggs everywhere these days."
And then the silence of the night is split like milk by a single, sawn-off shriek. Somebody lurches against the inside of the clock tower door. It is wrenched open. There is a crash, and something streaks out onto black tarmac. Inspector Vakil leaps into action, swinging up his rifle, shooting from the hip like John Wayne. Sweepers extract marksmen's weapons from their brushes and blaze away. Shrieks of excited women, yells of servants. Silence. What lies brown and black, banded and serpentine on the black tarmac? What leaking black blood provokes Dr. Schapsteker to screech from his top-floor vantage point?
"You complete fools! Brothers of cockroaches, sons of transvestites!"
What flick tongue dies while Vakil races onto tarred roof? And inside the clock tower door, what weight, falling, created such an almighty crash? Whose hand wrenched a door open? In whose heel are visible the two red flowing holes filled with a venom for which there is no known antivenin, a poison which has killed stablefuls of worn-out horses? Whose body is carried out of the tower by plainclothes men in a dead march, coffinless, with imitation sweepers for pallbearers? Why, when the moonlight falls upon the dead face, does Mary Pereira fall like a sack of potatoes to the floor, eyes rolling upwards in their sockets in a sudden and dramatic faint? And lining the interior walls of the clock tower, what are these strange mechanisms attached to cheap timepieces? Why are there so many bottles with rags stuffed into their necks?
"Damn lucky you called my boys out, Begum Sahiba," Inspector Vakil is saying. "That was Joseph Da Costa, on our most wanted list. Been after him for a year or thereabouts. Absolute black-hearted budmash. You should see the walls inside that clock tower. Shelves filled from floor to ceiling with homemade bombs. Enough explosive power to blow this hill into the sea."
Melodrama piling upon melodrama, life acquiring the colouring of a Bombay talkie, snakes following ladders, ladders succeeding snakes, in the midst of too much incident, baby Salim fell ill. As if incapable of assimilating so many goings-on, he closed his eyes and became red and flushed. While Amina awaited the results of Ishmael's case against the state authorities, while the brass monkey grew in her womb, while Mary entered a state of shock from which she would fully emerge only when Joseph's ghost returned to haunt her, while umbilical cord hung in pickle jar and Mary's chutneys filled our dreams with pointing fingers, while Reverend Mother ran the kitchens, my grandfather examined me and said, "I'm afraid there is no doubt. The poor lad has typhoid."
"Oh, God in heaven!" Reverend Mother cried out. "What dark devil has come, what's his name, to sit upon this house?"
This is how I have heard the story of the illness which nearly stopped me before I started. Day and night, at the end of August 1948, Mother and Grandfather looked after me. Mary dragged herself out of her guilt and pressed cold flannels to my forehead. Reverend Mother sang lullabies and spooned food into my mouth. Even my father, forgetting momentarily his own disorders, stood flapping helplessly in the doorway. But the night came when Dr. Aziz, looking as broken as an old horse, said,
"There is nothing more I can do. He will be dead by morning."
And in the midst of wailing women and the incipient labour of my mother, who had been pushed into it by grief and the tearing of Mary Pereira's hair, there was a knock. A servant announced Dr. Shapstecker, who handed my grandfather a little bottle and said, "I make no bones about it. This is kill or cure. 2 drops exactly. Then wait and see." My grandfather, sitting, head in hands, in the rubble of his medical learning, asked, "What is it?" And Dr. Shapstecker, nearly 82, tongue flicking at the corners of his mouth, "Diluted venin of the king cobra. It has been known to work." Snakes can lead to triumph just as ladders can be descended. My grandfather, knowing I would die anyway, administered the cobra poison. The family stood and watched while poison spread through the child's body, and 6 hours later my temperature had returned to normal. After that, my growth rate lost its phenomenal aspects, but something was given in exchange for what was lost. Life, and an early awareness of the ambiguity of snakes. While my temperature came down, my sister was being born at Nalika's nursing home. It was September the 1st, and the birth was so uneventful, so effortless, that it passed virtually unnoticed on Methil's estate, because on the same day, Ishmael Ibrahim visited my parents at the clinic and announced that the case had been won. While Ishmael celebrated, I was grabbing the bars of my cot, while he cried, "So much for freezes! Your assets are your own again, by order of the High Court." I was heaving, red-faced against gravity, and while Ishmael announced, with a straight face, "Sinhai bai, the rule of law has won a famous victory," and avoided my mother's delighted, triumphant eyes, I, baby Salim, aged exactly 1 year, 2 weeks, and 1 day, hauled myself upright in my cot. The effects of the events of that day were twofold. I grew up with legs that were irretrievably bowed, because I had got to my feet too early, and the brass monkey, so-called because of a thick thatch of red-gold hair, which would not darken until she was 9, learned that if she was going to get any attention in her life, she would have to make plenty of noise. Accident in a washing chest. It has been 2 whole days since Padma stormed out of my life. For 2 days, her place at the vat of Mango Kasundi has been taken by another woman, also thick of waist, also hairy of forearm, but, in my eyes, no replacement at all. While my own dung lotus has vanished into I don't know where, a balance has been upset. I feel cracks widening down the length of my body, because suddenly I am alone, without my necessary ear. And it isn't enough. I am seized by a sudden fist of anger. Why should I be so unreasonably treated by my one disciple? Other men have recited stories before me. Other men were not so impetuously abandoned. When Valmiki, the author of the Ramayana, dictated his masterpiece to elephant-headed Ganesh, did the god walk out on him halfway? He certainly did not. Note that, despite my Muslim background, I am enough of a Bombayite to be well up in Hindu stories. And actually, I'm very fond of the image of trunk-nosed, flap-eared Ganesh solemnly taking dictation. How to dispense with Padma? How give up her ignorance and superstition, necessary counterweights to my miracle-laden omniscience? How to do without a paradoxical earthiness of spirit which kept my feet on the ground? I have become, it seems to me, the apex of an isosceles triangle, supported equally by twin deities, the wild god of memory and the lotus goddess of the present. But must I now become reconciled to the narrow one-dimensionality of a straight line? I am, perhaps, hiding behind all these questions. Yes, perhaps that's right. I should speak plainly, without the cloak of a question mark. Our Padma has gone, and I miss her. Yes, that's it. But there is still work to be done. For instance, in the summer of 1956, when most things in the world were still larger than myself, my sister, the brass monkey, developed the curious habit of setting fire to shoes. while NASA sank ships at Suez, thus slowing down the movements of the world by obliging it to travel around the Cape of Good Hope, my sister was also trying to impede our progress. Obliged to fight for attention, possessed by her need to place herself at the centre of events, even of unpleasant ones, she was my sister after all, but no Prime Minister wrote letters to her, no Sadhus watched her from their places under garden taps, unprophesied, unphotographed. Her life was a struggle from the start. She carried her war into the world of footwear, hoping, perhaps, that by burning our shoes, she would make us stand still long enough to notice that she was there. She made no attempt at concealing her crimes. When my father entered his room to find a pair of black Oxfords on fire, the brass monkey was standing over them, match in hand. His nostrils were assailed by the unprecedented odour of ignited boot leather, mingled with cherry blossom boot polish and a little three-in-one oil.
"Look, Abba," the monkey said charmingly. "Look how pretty! Just the exact colour of my hair!"
Despite all precautions, the merry red flowers of my sister's obsession blossomed all over the estate that summer, blooming in the sandals of Nussie the Duck and the film magnet footwear of Homie Catrack. Hair-coloured flames licked at Mr. DeBus's down-at-heel suede and at Leela Sabamati's stiletto heels. Despite the concealment of matches and the vigilance of servants, the brass monkey found her ways, undeterred by punishment and threats. For 1 year on and off, Methel's estate was assailed by the fumes of incendiarized shoes, until her hair darkened into anonymous brown, and she seemed to lose interest in matches. Aminus and I, abhorring the idea of beating her children, temperamentally incapable of raising her voice, came close to her wit's end. And the monkey was sentenced for day after day to silence. This was my mother's chosen disciplinary method. Unable to strike us, she ordered us to seal our lips. Some echo, no doubt, of the great silence with which her own mother had tormented Adam Aziz, lingered in her ears, because silence too has an echo, hollower and longer lasting than the reverberations of any sound. And with an emphatic chup, she would place a finger across her lips and command our tongues to be still. It was a punishment which never failed to cow me into submission. The brass monkey, however, was made of less pliant stuff. Soundlessly, behind lips clamped tight as her grandmother's, she plotted the incineration of leather. Just as once, long ago, another monkey in another city had performed the act which made inevitable the burning of a leather cloth godown. She was as beautiful, if somewhat scrawny, as I was ugly, but she was from the first mischievous as a whirlwind and noisy as a crowd. Count the windows and vases broken accidentally on purpose. Number, if you can, the meals that somehow flew off her treacherous dinner plates to stain valuable Persian rugs. Silence was indeed the worst punishment she could have been given. But she bore it cheerfully, standing innocently amid the ruins of broken chairs and shattered ornaments. Mary Pereira said, "That one, that monkey, should have been born with four legs." But Amina, in whose mind the memory of her narrow escape from giving birth to a two-headed son had obstinately refused to fade, cried, "Mary, what are you saying? Don't even think such things." Despite my mother's protestations, it was true that the brass monkey was as much animal as human, and, as all the servants and children on Methel's estate knew, she had the gift of talking to birds and to cats. Dogs, too, but after she was bitten at the age of six by a supposedly rabid stray and had to be dragged kicking and screaming to Breach Candy Hospital every afternoon for 3 weeks to be given an injection in the stomach, it seems she either forgot their language or else refused to have any further dealings with them. From birds she learned how to sing. From cats she learned a form of dangerous independence. The brass monkey was never so furious as when anyone spoke to her in words of love. Desperate for affection, deprived of it by my overpowering shadow, she had a tendency to turn upon anyone who gave her what she wanted, as if she were defending herself against the possibility of being tricked. Such as the time when Sonny Ibrahim plucked up his courage to tell her Hey, listen, Salim, sister, you're a solid type. I'm, damn keen on you. And at once she marched across to where his father and mother were sipping lassi in the gardens of Sans Souci to say, Nussie, auntie, I don't know what your sonny's been getting up to. Only just now I saw him and Cyrus behind a bush doing such funny rubbing things with their susus. The brass monkey had bad table manners. She trampled flower beds. She acquired the tag of problem child. But she and I were close as close, in spite of frame letters from Delhi and Sadhu under the tap. From the beginning, I decided to treat her as an ally, not a competitor, and, as a result, she never once blamed me for my preeminence in our household, saying, "What's to blame? Is it your fault if they think you're so great?" But when, years later, I made the same mistake as Sunny, she treated me just the same. And it was Monkey who, by answering a certain wrong number telephone call, began the process of events which led to my accident in a white washing chest made of slatted wood. Already at the age of nearly 9, I knew this much. Everybody was waiting for me. Midnight and baby snaps, prophets and prime ministers had created around me a glowing and inescapable mist of expectancy, in which my father pulled me into his squashy belly in the cool of the cocktail hour to say, "Great things, my son. What is not in store for you? Great deeds, a great life." While I, wriggling between jutting lip and big toe, wetting his shirt with my eternally leaking nose goo, turned scarlet and squealed, "Let me go, Abba, everyone will see." And he, embarrassing me beyond belief, bellowed, "Let them look. Let the whole world see how I love my son." And my grandmother, visiting us one winter, gave me advice too. "Just pull up your socks, what's his name, and you'll be better than anyone in the whole wide world." Adrift in this haze of anticipation, I had already felt within myself the first movings of that shapeless animal which still, on these Padmaless nights, champs and scratches in my stomach, cursed by a multitude of hopes and nicknames. I had already acquired Sniffer and Snotnose. I became afraid that everyone was wrong, that my much-trumpeted existence might turn out to be utterly useless, void, and without the shred of a purpose. And it was to escape from this beast that I took to hiding myself from an early age in my mother's large white washing chest. Because although the creature was inside me, the comforting presence of enveloping soiled linen seemed to lull it into sleep. Outside the washing chest, surrounded by people who seemed to possess a devastatingly clear sense of purpose, I buried myself in fairy tales. Hatim Tai and Batman, Superman and Sinbad helped to get me through the nearly 9 years. When I went shopping with Mary Pereira, overawed by her ability to tell a chicken's age by looking at its neck, by the sheer determination with which she stared dead pomfrets in the eyes, I became Aladdin, voyaging in a fabulous cave, watching servants dusting vases with a dedication as majestic as it was obscure. I imagined Ali Baba's 40 thieves hiding in the dusted urns in the garden, staring at Purushottam the Sadhu being eroded by water. I turned into the genie of the lamp and thus avoided, for the most part, the terrible notion that I, alone in the universe, had no idea what I should be or how I should behave. Purpose. It crept up behind me when I stood staring down from my window at European girls cavorting in the map-shaped pool beside the sea. "Where do you get it?" I yelped aloud. The brass monkey, who shared my sky-blue room, jumped halfway out of her skin. I was then nearly 8. She was almost 7. It was a very early age at which to be perplexed by meaning. But servants are excluded from washing chests. School buses, too, are absent. In my nearly 9th year, I had begun to attend the Cathedral and John Connon Boys High School on Outram Road in the old Fort District. Washed and brushed every morning, I stood at the foot of our 2-story hillock, white-shorted, wearing a blue-striped elastic belt with a snake buckle, satchel over my shoulder, my mighty cucumber of a nose dripping as usual. Eye slice and hair oil, Sunny Ibrahim, and precocious Cyrus the Great waited too, And on the bus, amid rattling seats and the nostalgic cracks of the window panes, what certainties, what nearly 9-year-old certitudes about the future. A boast from Sonny, I'm going to be a bullfighter, Spain. Chiquitas. Hey, Toro, Toro! His satchel held before him like the muleta of Manolete. He enacted his future while the bus rattled around Kemp's Corner, past Thomas Kemp and Company, chemists. Beneath the Air India Rajas poster, see you later, alligator, I'm off to London on Air India. And the other hoarding, on which, throughout my childhood, the Kolinos kid, a gleam-toothed pixie in a green elfin chlorophyll hat, proclaimed the virtues of Kolinos toothpaste. Keep teeth clean and keep teeth bright, keep teeth Kolinos super white. The kid on his hoarding, the children in the bus, one-dimensional, flattened by certitude, they knew what they were for. Here is Glandy Keith Colico, a thyroid balloon of a child, with hair already sprouting tuftily on his lip.
I'm going to run my father's cinemas. You bastards want to watch movies? You'll have to come and beg me for seats.
And Fat Purse Fishwaller, whose obesity is due to nothing but overeating, and who, along with Glandy Keith, occupies the privileged position of class bully.
Bah! That's nothing! I'll have diamonds and emeralds and moonstones! Pearls as big as my balls!
Fat Percy's father runs the city's other jewellery business. His great enemy is the son of Mr. Fatboy, who, being small and intellectual, comes off badly in the war of the pearl testicle children. And Icelice, announcing his future as a test cricketer, with a fine disregard for his one empty socket. And Hair Oil, who is as slicked down and neat as his brother is curly-topped and dishevelled, says,
"What selfish bums you are! I shall follow my father into the navy. I shall defend my country."
Whereupon he is pelted with rulers, compasses, inky pellets. In the school bus, as it clattered past Chowpatty Beach, as it turned left off Marine Drive, beside the apartment of my favourite Uncle Anif, and headed past Victoria Terminus, and towards Flora Fountain, past Churchgate Station and Crawford Market, I held my peace. I was mild-mannered Clark Kent, protecting my secret identity. But what on earth was that?
"Hey, Snotnose," Glandy Keith yelled. "Hey, what do you suppose our sniffer will grow up to be?"
And the answering yell from Fat Purse Fishwaller,
"Pinocchio!"
And the rest joining in, sing a raucous chorus of, "There are no strings on me," while Cyrus the Great sits quiet as a genius and plans the future of the nation's leading nuclear research establishment. And at home, there was the brass monkey with her shoe burning, and my father, who had emerged from the depths of his collapse to fall once more into the folly of tetrapods.
"Where do you find it?" I pleaded at my window. The fisherman's finger pointed misleadingly out to sea.
Ban from washing chests, cries of Pinocchio, cucumber nose, goo face, concealed in my hiding place. I was safe from the memory of Miss Capadia, the teacher at Breach Candy Kindergarten, who had, on my first day at school, turned from a blackboard to greet me, seen my nose and dropped her duster in alarm, smashing the nail on her big toe in a screechy but minor echo of my father's famous mishap. Buried amongst soiled hankies and crumpled pyjamas, I could forget, for a time, my ugliness. Typhoid attacked me. Crate poison cured me, and my early, overheated growth rate cooled off. By the time I was nearly 9, Sonny Ibrahim was an inch and a half taller than I. But one piece of baby Salim seemed immune to disease and extract of snakes. Between my eyes it mushroomed outwards and downwards, as if all my expansionist forces driven out of the rest of my body had decided to concentrate on this single incomparable thrust. Between my eyes and above my lips, my nose bloomed like a prize marrow. But then I was spared wisdom teeth. One should try to count one's blessings. "What's in a nose?" The usual answer, that simple. A breathing apparatus, olfactory organs, hairs. But in my case, the answer was simpler still,
although I'm bound to admit, somewhat repellent. What was in my nose was snot. With apologies, I must unfortunately insist on details. Nasal congestion obliged me to breathe through my mouth, giving me the air of a gasping goldfish. Perennial blockages doomed me to a childhood without perfumes, to days which ignored the odours of musk and chambali and mango kasundi and homemade ice cream and dirty washing too. A disability in the world outside washing chests can be a positive advantage once you're in, but only for the duration of your stay. Purpose-obsessed, I worried about my nose. Dressed in the bitter garments which arrived regularly from my headmistress, Aunt Alia, I went to school, played French cricket, fought, entered fairy tales, and worried. In those days, my Aunt Alia had begun to send us an unending stream of children's clothes, into whose seams she had sewn her old maid's bile. The brass monkey and I were clothed in her gifts, wearing at first the baby things of bitterness, then the rompers of resentment. I grew up in white shorts starched with the starch of jealousy, while the monkey wore the pretty flowered frocks of Alia's undimmed envy. Unaware that our wardrobe was binding us in the webs of her revenge, we led our well-dressed lives. My nose, elephantine as the trunk of Ganesh, it should, I thought, have been a superlative breather, a smeller without an answer, as we say. Instead, it was permanently bunged up and useless as a wooden Sikh kebab. Enough. I sat in the washing chest and forgot my nose. Forgot about the climbing of Mount Everest in 1953, when grubby Ice Slice giggled, "Hey, man, you think that Tenzing could climb up Sniffer's face?" And about the quarrels between my parents over my nose, for which Amitz and I never tired of blaming Amina's father. "Never before in my family has there been a nose like it. We have excellent noses, proud noses, royal noses, wife." Amitz and I had already begun at that time to believe in the fictional ancestry he had created for the benefit of William Methold. Gin-sodden, he saw Mughal blood running in his veins. Forgotten, too, the night when I was 8 and a half, and my father, gins on his breath, came into my bedroom to rip the sheets off me and demand, "What are you up to, pig? Pig from somewhere?" I looked sleepy, innocent, puzzled. He roared on, "Chee-chee! Filthy! God punishes boys who do that. Already he's made your nose as big as poplars. He'll stunt your growth. He'll make your susu shrivel up." And my mother, arriving night-dressed in the startled room, "Janum, for pity's sake, the boy was only sleeping." The gin roared through my father's lips, possessing him completely. "Look on his face. Whoever got a nose like that from sleeping?" There are no mirrors in a washing chest. Rude jokes do not enter it, nor pointing fingers. The rage of fathers is muffled by used sheets and discarded brassieres. A washing chest is a hole in the world, a place which civilization has put outside itself, beyond the pale. This makes it the finest of hiding places. In the washing chest, I was like Nadir Khan in his underworld, safe from all pressures, concealed from the demands of parents and history. My father, pulling me into his squashy belly, speaking in a voice choked with instant emotion, all right there, there, you're a good boy. You can be anything you want. You just have to want it enough. Sleep now." And Mary Pereira, echoing him in her little rhyme, "Anything you want to be, you can be. You can be just what all you want." It had already occurred to me that our family believed implicitly in good business principles. They expected a handsome return for their investment in me. Children get food, shelter, pocket money, long holidays, and love. All of it apparently free, gratis, and most of the little fools think it's a sort of compensation for having been born. "There are no strings on me," they sing. But I, Pinocchio, saw the strings. Parents are impelled by the profit motive. Nothing more, nothing less. For their attentions, they expected from me the immense dividend of greatness. Don't misunderstand me, I didn't mind. I was, at that time, a dutiful child. I longed to give them what they wanted, what soothsayers and framed letters had promised them. I simply did not know how. Where did greatness come from? How did you get some? When? When I was 7 years old, Adam Aziz and Reverend Mother came to visit us. On my 7th birthday, dutifully, I permitted myself to be dressed up like the boys in the fisherman picture. Hot and constricted in the outlandish garb, I smiled and smiled. "See my little piece of the moon," Amina cried, cutting a cake covered with candied farmyard animals. "So sweet. Never takes out one tear." Sandbagging down the floods of tears lurking just beneath my eyes, the tears of heat, discomfort, and the absence of 1 yard of chocolates in my pile of presents, I took a slice of cake to Reverend Mother, who was ill in bed. I had been given a doctor's stethoscope. It was around my neck. She gave me permission to examine her. I prescribed more exercise. "You must walk across the room to the Almira and back once a day. You may lean on me. I am the doctor." Stethoscoped. "English, my lord," guided witch-mould grandmother across the room. Hobblingly, creakingly, she obeyed. After 3 months of this treatment, she made a full recovery. The neighbours came to celebrate, bearing rasagullas and gulab jamuns and other sweets. Reverend Mother, seated regally on a tuft in the living room, announced, "See my grandson. He cured me. What's his name? Genius! Genius! What's his name? It's a gift from God." Was that it, then? Should I stop worrying? Was genius something utterly unconnected with wanting, or learning how, or knowing about, or being able to? Something which, at the appointed hour, would float down around my shoulders like an immaculate, delicately worked pashmina shawl? Greatness as a falling mantle, which never needed to be sent to the dhobi. One does not beat genius upon a stone. That one clue, my grandmother's one chance sentence, was my only hope. And, as it turned out, she wasn't very far wrong. The accident is almost upon me, and the children of midnight are waiting. Years later in Pakistan, on the very night when the roof was to fall in on her head and squash her flatter than a rice pancake, Amina Sanai saw the old washing chest in a vision. When it popped up inside her eyelids, she greeted it like a not particularly welcome cousin. "So, it's you again," she told it. "Well, why not? Things keep coming back to me these days. Seems you just can't leave anything behind." She had grown prematurely old, like all the women in our family. The chest reminded her of the year in which old age had first begun creeping up on her. The great heat of 1956, which Mary Pereira told me was caused by little blazing invisible insects, buzzed in her ears once again. "My corns began killing me then," she said aloud, and the civil defence official who had called to enforce the blackout smiled sadly to himself and thought, "Old people shroud themselves in the past during a war. That way they're ready to die whenever required." He crept away past the mountains of defective terry towels, which filled most of the house, and left Amina to discuss her dirty laundry in private. Nussi Ibrahim, Nussi the duck, used to admire Amina. "Such posture, my dear, that you've got, such tone. I swear it's a wonder to me. You glide about like you're on an invisible trolley." But in the summer of the heat insects, my elegant mother finally lost her battle against verrucas, because the sadhu, Purushottam, suddenly lost his magic. Water had worn a bald patch in his hair. The steady dripping of the years had worn him down. Was he disillusioned with his blessed child, his Mubarak? Was it my fault that his mantras lost their power? With an air of great trouble, he told my mother, "Never mind, wait only. I'll fix your feet for sure." But Amina's corns grew worse. She went to doctors who froze them with carbon dioxide at absolute zero. But that only brought them back with redoubled vigour, so that she began to hobble. Her gliding days gone forever, and she recognised the unmistakable greeting of old age. Chock full of fantasy, I transformed her into a silky. "Amma, maybe you're a mermaid, really, taking human form for the love of a man, so every step is like walking on razor blades." My mother smiled, but did not laugh. 1956, Amit Sanai and Dr. Nalika played chess and argued. My father was a bitter opponent of Nasser, while Nalika admired him openly. "The man is bad for business," Amit said. "But he's got style," Nalika responded, glowing passionately, Nobody pushes him around. At the same time, Jawaharlal Nehru was consulting astrologers about the country's 5-year plan in order to avoid another Karamstan. And while the world combined aggression and the occult, I lay concealed in a washing chest, which wasn't really big enough for comfort anymore, and Amina Sanai became filled with guilt. She was already trying to put out of her mind her adventure at the racetrack, but the sense of sin which her mother's cooking had given her could not be escaped. So it was not difficult for her to think of the Varukas as a punishment. Not only for the years ago escapade at Mahalakshmi, but for failing to save her husband from the pink chitties of alcoholism, for the brass monkey's untamed, unfeminine ways, and for the size of her only son's nose. Looking back at her now, it seems to me that a fog of guilt had begun to form around her head, her black skin exuding black cloud, which hung before her eyes. Padma would believe it. Padma would know what I mean. And as her guilt grew, the fog thickened. Yes, why not? There were days when you could hardly see her head above her neck. Amina had become one of those rare people who take the burdens of the world upon their own backs. She began to exude the magnetism of the willingly guilty. And from then on, everyone who came into contact with her felt the most powerful of urges to confess their own private guilts. When they succumbed to my mother's powers, she would smile at them with a sweet, sad, foggy smile, and they would go away, lightened, leaving their burdens on her shoulders. And the fog guilt thickened. Amina heard about servants being beaten and officials being bribed. When my uncle Hanif and his wife, the divine peer, came to call, they related their quarrels in minute detail. Leela Sabarmati confided her infidelities to my mother's graceful, inclined, long-suffering ear, and Mary Pereira had to fight constantly against the almost irresistible temptation to confess her crime. Faced with the guilts of the world, my mother smiled foggily and shut her eyes tight. And by the time the roof fell in on her head, her eyesight was badly impaired, but she could still see the washing chest. What was really at the bottom of my mother's guilt? I mean, really, beneath Varukas and jinns and confessions. It was an unspeakable malaise, an affliction which could not even be named, and which no longer confined itself to dreams of an underworld husband. My mother had fallen, as my father would soon fall, under the spell of the telephone. In the afternoons of that summer, afternoons as hot as towels, the telephone would ring. When Amit Sanai was asleep in his room, with his keys under his pillow and umbilical cords in his almirah, telephonic shrilling penetrated the buzzing of the heat insects, and my mother, Varuka Hobbled, came into the hall to answer. And now, what expression is this? Staining her face the colour of drying blood, not knowing that she's being observed. What fish-like flutterings of lips are these? What strangulated mouthings? And why, after listening for a full 5 minutes, does my mother say in a voice like broken glass, "Sorry, wrong number." Why are diamonds glistening on her eyelids? The brass monkey whispered to me, "Next time it rings, let's find out." 5 days later, once more, it is afternoon. But today, Amina is away, visiting Nusi the duck, when the telephone demands attention. "Quick, quick, or it'll wake him." The monkey, agile as her name, picks up the receiver before Amit Sanai has even changed the pattern of his snoring. "Hello, Yas? This is 70561. Hello?" We listen, every nerve on edge, but for a moment there is nothing at all. Then, when we're about to give up, the voice comes. "Oh, yes, hello." And the monkey shouting almost, "Hello, who is it, please?" Silence again. The voice, which has not been able to prevent itself from speaking, considers its answer and then, "Hello, this is Shanti Prasad Truck Hire Company, please." And the monkey, quick as a flash, "Yes, what do you want?" Another pause. The voice, sounding embarrassed, apologetic almost, says, "I want to rent a truck." "Oh, feeble excuse of telephonic voice, oh, transparent flummery of ghosts. The voice on the phone was no truck renter's voice. It was soft, a little fleshy, the voice of a poet. But after that, the telephone rang regularly. Sometimes my mother answered it, listened in silence while her mouth made fish motions, and finally, much too late, said, "Sorry, wrong number." At other times the monkey and I clustered around it, 2 ears to earpiece, while the monkey took orders for trucks. I wondered, "Hey, monkey, what do you think? Doesn't the guy ever wonder why the trucks don't arrive?" And she, wide-eyed, flutter-voiced, "Man, do you suppose maybe they do?" But I couldn't see how. And a tiny seed of suspicion was planted in me, a tiny glimmering of a notion that our mother might have a secret, our Amma, who always said, "Keep secrets and they'll go bad inside you. Don't tell things and they'll give you stomachache." A minute spark which my experience in the washing chest would fan into a forest fire. Because this time, you see, she gave me proof. And now, at last, it is time for dirty laundry. Mary Pereira was fond of telling me, "If you want to be a big man, Baba, you must be very clean. Change clothes," she advised. "Take regular baths. Go, Baba, or I'll send you to the washerman, and he'll wallop you on his stone." She also threatened me with bugs. "All right, stay filthy. You will be nobody's darling except the flies. They will sit on you while you sleep. Eggs they'll lay under your skin." In part, my choice of hiding place was an act of defiance. Braving dhobis and houseflies, I concealed myself in the unclean place. I drew strength and comfort from sheets and towels. My nose ran freely into the stone-doomed linens. And always, when I emerged into the world from my wooden whale, the sad, mature wisdom of dirty washing lingered with me, teaching me its philosophy of coolness and dignity despite everything, and the terrible inevitability of soap. One afternoon in June, I tiptoed down the corridors of the sleeping house towards my chosen refuge, sneaked past my sleeping mother into the white tile silence of her bathroom, lifted the lid off my goal, and plunged into its soft continuum of predominantly white textiles, whose only memories were of my earlier visits. Sighing softly, I pulled down the lid and allowed pants and vests to massage away the pains of being alive, purposeless and nearly 9 years old. Electricity in the air, heat buzzing like bees, a mantle hanging somewhere in the sky, waiting to fall gently around my shoulders. Somewhere, a finger reaches towards a dial. A dial whirs around and around. Electrical pulses dart along cable. 70561. The telephone rings. Muffled shrilling of a bell penetrates the washing chest, in which a nearly 9-year-old boy lies uncomfortably concealed. I, Salim, became stiff with the fear of discovery, because now more noises entered the chest. Squeak of bedsprings, soft clatter of slippers along corridor, the telephone silenced in mid-shrill and... or is this imagination? Was her voice too soft to hear? The words spoken too late as usual? "Sorry, wrong number." And now, hobbling footsteps returning to the bedroom. And the worst fears of the hiding boy are fulfilled. Doorknobs turning, scream warnings at him, razor-sharp steps cut him deeply as they move across cool white tiles. He stays frozen as ice, still as a stick. His nose drips silently into dirty clothes. A pyjama cord, snake-like harbinger of doom, inserts itself into his left nostril. To sniff would be to die. He refuses to think about it. Clamped tight in the grip of terror, he finds his eye looking through a chink in the dirty washing and sees a woman crying in a bathroom, rain dropping from a thick black cloud. And now more sound, more motion. His mother's voice has begun to speak, 2 syllables over and over again. And her hands have begun to move. Ears muffled by underwear strain to catch the sounds. That one, dir, bur, dil. And the other, ha, ra. No, na, ha and ra are banished. Dil and bur vanish forever. and the boy hears in his ears a name which has not been spoken since Mumtaz Aziz became Amina Sinai. Nadir. Nadir. Na-der-na. And her hands are moving, lost in their memory of other days, of what happened after games of hit the spittoon in an Agra cellar. They flutter gladly at her cheeks. They hold her bosom tighter than any brassieres, and now they caress her bare midriff. They stray below decks. Yes, this is what we used to do, my love. It was enough, enough for me, even though my father made us, and you ran, and now the telephone. Nadir, 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 Nadir. Hands which held telephone now hold flesh, while in another place, what does another hand do? To what, after replacing receiver, is another hand getting up? No matter, because here, in her spied-out privacy, Amina Sinai repeats an ancient name again and again, until finally she bursts out with, "Are Nadir Khan, where have you come from now?" Secrets. A man's name. Never before glimpsed motions of the hands. A boy's mind filled with thoughts which have no shape, tormented by ideas which refuse to settle into words, and in a left nostril a pajama cord is snaking up, 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 refusing to be ignored. And now, oh, shameless mother, revealer of duplicity of emotions which have no place in family life, and more, oh, brazen unveiler of black mango, Amina Sinai, drying her eyes, is summoned by a more trivial necessity. And as her son's right eye peers out through the wooden slats at the top of the washing chest, my mother unwinds her sari, while I, silently in the washing chest, "Don't do it, don't do it, don't do." But I cannot close my eye. Unblinking pupil takes in upside-down image of sari falling to the floor, an image which is, as usual, inverted by the mind. Through ice-blue eyes I see a slip follow the sari, and then, oh! Horrible. My mother, framed in laundry and slatted wood, bends over to pick up her clothes, and there it is, searing my retina, the vision of my mother's rump, black as night, rounded and curved, resembling nothing on earth so much as a gigantic black Alfonso mango. In the washing chest, unnerved by the vision, I wrestle with myself. Self-control becomes simultaneously imperative and impossible. Under the thunderclap influence of the black mango, my nerve cracks, pajama cord wins its victory, and while Amina Sinai seats herself on a commode, I... What? Not sneeze. It was less than a sneeze. Not a twitch either. It was more than that. It's time to talk plainly. Shattered by two syllabic voice and fluttering hands, devastated by black mango, the nose of Salim Sinai, responding to the evidence of maternal duplicity, quivering at the presence of maternal rump, gave way to a pajama cord and was possessed by a cataclysmic, a world-altering, an irreversible sniff. Pajama cord rises painfully half an inch further up the nostril, but other things are rising too, hauled by that feverish inhalation. Nasal liquids are being sucked relentlessly up, 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 nose goo, flowing upwards against gravity, against nature. Sinuses are subjected to unbearable pressure until, inside the nearly nine-year-old head, something bursts. Snot rockets through a breached dam into dark new channels, mucus rising higher than mucus was ever intended to rise, waste fluid reaching as far, perhaps, as the frontiers of the brain. There is a shock. Something electrical has been moistened. Pain. And then noise, deafening, many-tongued, terrifying, inside his head, inside a white wooden washing chest, within the darkened auditorium of my skull. My nose began to sing. But just now, there isn't time to listen, because one voice is very close indeed. Amina Sinai has opened the lower door of the washing chest. I am tumbling down, down, with laundry wrapped around my head like a cowl. Pajama cord jerks out of my nose, and now there is lightning flashing through the dark clouds around my mother, and a refuge has been lost forever. "I didn't look," I squealed up through socks and sheets. "I didn't see one thing, Ami, I swear." And years later, in a cane chair among reject towels and a radio announcing exaggerated war victories, Amina would remember how with thumb and forefinger around the ear of a lying son, she led him to Mary Pereira, who was sleeping, as usual, on a cane mat in a sky-blue room, how she said, "This young donkey, this good-for-nothing from nowhere, is not to speak for one whole day." And just before the roof fell in on her, she said aloud, "It was my fault. I brought him up too badly." As the explosion of the bomb ripped through the air, she added, mildly but firmly, addressing her last words on earth to the ghost of a washing chest, "Go away now. I've seen enough of you." On Mount Sinai, the prophet Musa, or Moses, heard disembodied commandments. On Mount Hira, the prophet Muhammad, also known as Muhammad, Mahomet, the last but one, and Mahound, spoke to the archangel Gabriel, or Jibril, as you please. And on the stage of the cathedral and John Connon Boys High School, run under the auspices of the Anglo-Scottish Education Society, my friend Cyrus the Great, playing a female part as usual, heard the voices of St. Joan speaking the sentences of Bernard Shaw. But Cyrus is the odd one out, unlike Joan, whose voices were heard in a field. But like Musa or Moses, like Muhammad the penultimate, I heard voices on a hill. Muhammad, on whose name be peace, let me add, I don't want to offend anyone, heard a voice saying, "Recite," and thought he was going mad. I heard at first a headful of gabbling tongues, like an untuned radio, and with lips sealed by maternal command, I was unable to ask for comfort. Muhammad, at 40, sought and received reassurance from wife and friends. "Verily," they told him, "you are the messenger of God." I, suffering my punishment at nearly 9, could neither seek Brass Monkey's assistance nor solicit softening words from Mary Pereira. Muted for an evening and a night and a morning, I struggled alone to understand what had happened to me, until at last I saw the shawl of genius fluttering down like an embroidered butterfly, the mantle of greatness settling upon my shoulders. In the heat of that silent night, I was silent. Outside me, the sea rustled like distant paper. Crows squawked in the throes of their feathery nightmares, the puttering noises of tardy taxicabs wafted up from Warden Road, the Brass Monkey, before she fell asleep, with her face frozen into a mask of curiosity, begged, "Come on, Salim, nobody's listening. What did you do? Tell, tell, tell." While inside me the voices rebounded against the walls of my skull. I was gripped by hot fingers of excitement. The agitated insects of excitement danced in my stomach, because finally, in some way I did not then fully understand, the door which Toxicatrac had once nudged in my head had been forced open. And through it I could glimpse, shadowy still, undefined, enigmatic, my reason for having been born. Gabriel, or Jibril, told Muhammad, "Recite," and then began the recitation known in Arabic as Al-Quran. "Recite in the name of the Lord thy Creator, who created man from clots of blood." That was on Mount Hira, outside Mecca Sharif. On a two-story hillock opposite Breach Candy Pools, voices also instructed me to recite, "Tomorrow." I thought excitedly, "Tomorrow." By sunrise, I had discovered that the voices could be controlled. I was a radio receiver and could turn the volume down or up. I could select individual voices. I could even, by an effort of will, switch off my newly discovered inner ear. It was astonishing how soon fear left me. By morning, I was thinking, "Man, this is better than All India Radio, man, better than Radio Ceylon." To demonstrate the loyalty of sisters, when the 24 hours were up on the dot, the Brass Monkey ran into my mother's bedroom. It was, I think, a Sunday, no school, or perhaps not. That was the summer of the language marches, and the schools were often shut, because of the danger of violence on the bus routes. "The time's up," she exclaimed, shaking my mother out of sleep.
Amma, wake up! It's time. Can he talk now?
All right, my mother said, coming into a sky-blue room to embrace me. You're forgiven now, but never hide in there again.
Amma, I said eagerly, my ummi, please listen. I must tell you something, something big, but please, please, first of all, wake, Abba.
And after a period of what, why, and certainly not, my mother saw something extraordinary sitting in my eyes and went to wake Amit Sanai anxiously with, Janum, please come. I don't know what's got into Salim.
Family and Aya assembled in the sitting room.
Amid cut-glass vases and plump cushions, standing on a Persian rug beneath the swirling shadows of ceiling fans, I smiled into their anxious eyes and prepared my revelation. This was it, the beginning of the repayment of their investment, my first dividend. First, I was sure of many. My black mother, lip-jutting father, monkey of a sister and crime-concealing ayah waited in hot confusion.
Get it out. Straight, without frills.
You should be the first to know, I said, trying to give my speech the cadences of adulthood. And then I told them, I heard voices yesterday. Voices are speaking to me inside my head. I think, Ami, Abu, I really think that archangels have started to talk to me.
There, I thought, there, it's said. Now there will be pats on the back, sweetmeats, public announcements, maybe more photographs. Now their chests will puff up with pride. Oh, blind innocence of childhood. For my honesty, for my open-hearted desperation to please, I was set upon from all sides. Even the monkey, oh God, Salim, all this tamasha, all this performance, for one of your stupid cracks? And worse than the monkey was Mary Pereira. Christ Jesus, save us, Lord! Holy Father in Rome, such blasphemy I've heard today! And worse than Mary Pereira was my mother, Amina Sanai, black mango concealed now, her own unnameable name still warm upon her lips. She cried, Heaven forfend! The child will bring down the roof upon our heads! Was that my fault, too? And Amina continued, You black man, Gunda! Oh, Salim, has your brain gone raw? What has happened to my darling baby boy? Are you growing into a madman? A torturer? And worse than Amina's shrieking was my father's silence. Worse than her fear was the wild anger sitting on his forehead. And worst of all was my father's hand, which stretched out suddenly, thick-fingered, heavy-jointed, strong as an ox, to fetch me a mighty blow on the side of my head so that I could never hear properly in my left ear after that day. So that I fell sideways across the startled room, through the scandalized air, and shattered a green tabletop of opaque glass, so that, having been certain of myself for the first time in my life, I was plunged into a green, glass-cloudy world filled with cutting edges, a world in which I could no longer tell the people who mattered most about the goings-on inside my head. Green shards lacerated my hands as I entered that swirling universe in which I was doomed, until it was far too late to be plagued by constant doubts about what I was for. In a white-tiled bathroom beside a washing chest, my mother daubed me with mercurochrome. Gauze veiled my cuts, while through the door my father's voice commanded, Wife, let nobody give him food today, you hear me? Let him enjoy his joke on an empty stomach! That night, Amina Sanai would dream of Ramram Seth, who was floating 6 inches above the ground, his eye sockets filled with egg whites, intoning, Washing will hide him, voices will guide him. But when, after several days in which the dream sat upon her shoulders, wherever she went, she plucked up the courage to ask her disgraced son a little more about his outrageous claim, he replied in a voice as restrained as the unswept tears of his childhood, It was just fooling, Amma, a stupid joke like you.